So, as Ritten of You has said, this series around is on the six perfections and the Bodhisattva ideal. And it's a great theme to complement Buddhist Action Month, which carries on through to the end of June. So over the course of the next few weeks, we'll be hearing about the six qualities that a Bodhisattva actively cultivates. And we'll also address the question of what is a Bodhisattva and where are they pointing with their practice of the Dharma. So I'll be talking a little bit about the Bodhisattva as well tonight. So, as Ritten of You has said, last week he introduced the Bodhisattva ideal, and tonight I'm going to mostly be talking about the first two paramitas, or perfections, that the Bodhisattva practices, which are dana, or generosity, and sila, which is ethics. And I've drawn most of the material from the Essential Sangharachita, which has sort of become my Bible these days, a little bit from the Sutras Meeting the Buddhas, which we don't happen to have here, and the Bodhisattva ideal, as well as some other sources. But I want to begin by talking about what a Bodhisattva is, as they have been a great source of inspiration for me ever since I began my explorations into Buddhism. So Bodhisattva means enlightenment being, and for some of us, they are the great heroes and heroines of Buddhism. So they're both mythical and archetypal figures, as well as sometimes actual people, who have devoted their whole lives to the attainment of enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And they are beings who are well on their way to becoming Buddhas. So they have ceased feeling that they are apart from the rest of life, that they are separate from other beings. And through the development of prajna, or wisdom, they eventually come to see that self and other are conceptual categories that we impose on our experience of life. And they have discovered that it is impossible to gain enlightenment by just thinking only of ourselves. We can continuously work on ourselves and still find that we are surrounded by the immense suffering of others. So a Bodhisattva reaches out with wisdom and compassion to help all sentient beings. And Avalokiteshvara is one particular Bodhisattva who has great significance to the Triyatna Buddhist order. And he symbolises love and compassion and encourages living beings towards greater acts of altruism and self-transcendence. And he's found in many parts of the Mahayana and appears in different forms depending on the culture and the conditions he finds himself in. So sometimes he's portrayed as a majestic male sitting in a posture of royal ease, and at other times she is portrayed as Kuan Yin. This is Kuan Yin here. A beautiful and gentle female Bodhisattva in graceful robes. And there is a thousand-armed form whose many arms symbolise different aspects of his compassionate nature that enable him to reach out to help all sentient beings. And in the palm of each hand there is an eye, and these many eyes enable him to see the sufferings of all beings. And if you happen to stay for the meditation afterwards, there's an image of Avalokiteshvara on the shrine, the thousand-armed form. So in his central pair of hands, he holds the chintamani, or wish-fulfilling jewel. And this jewel represents the bodhicitta, the will towards enlightenment, which Ritten of You is going to talk a bit more about later in the series. And in other arms, he holds a rosary, or mala, which symbolises meditation, and a lotus flower, which represents wisdom. So these are his offerings to the world. He reminds us of the need for constantly repeating skillful actions in order to gain enlightenment. And he encourages us to go for refuge through altruism. So the essence of Avalokiteshvara is Maha Karuna, or great compassion, but he is also, like all the Bodhisattvas, symbolic of wisdom. And he's connected with the Heart Sutra in particular, which is a teaching on shunyata, or emptiness. So last week, Ritten of You has spoke a little about how Avalokiteshvara came to have a thousand arms, and it's such a good story that I'm going to... Pardon? That I'm going to repeat it tonight. So it began with him as making a vow in front of his teacher Amitabha, the ruby-red Buddha of infinite light. And in this vow he said, "May I have the opportunity to establish all living beings in happiness. Until I relieve all living beings, may I never, even for a moment, feel like giving up my efforts for the sake of others in exchange for my own peace and happiness. If ever I should think only of my own happiness, may my head be cracked in 10 pieces, and may my body be split like the petals of a lotus into 1,000 parts." and he then went amongst the people teaching the Dharma with infinite compassion. And after that he entered a deep meditation, and making an intense effort to dispel the sufferings of beings, he meditated for a very, very long time. And eventually emerging from meditation, he looked about him, and he saw that he had not helped even 100th of the people to gain liberation. And seized by a great and bitter sorrow, just for an instant the thought arose in him, what is the use? I can do nothing for them. It is better for me to be happy and peaceful myself. And at that very moment, his head cracked into 10 pieces and his body split into 1,000 parts. And in absolute agony, he called out to the Buddha Amitabha, who came instantly to his aid, transfiguring the 10 pieces of his head into 10 faces and making his torn flesh into 1,000 arms. And on the crown of the 10-faced head, Amitabha placed his own head, and then he radiated boundless, inconceivable light in all directions. And there's another very popular bodhisattva called Green Tara, who embodies compassion in the form of a young female goddess. And myth tells us that she was born from a lake of tears shed by Avalokiteshvara when he became overcome with immense pity for the suffering world. And it seems to me sometimes that Avalokiteshvara is very in touch with his emotions, which is why I think I have such a strong connection to him, especially the thousand-arm form and the female form of Kuan Yin. So in the Triyatna Buddhist order, the body of Avalokiteshvara symbolises the whole order, and the thousand arms represent individual order members reaching out, each in their own diverse and unique ways, to ease suffering by spreading the Dharma in the world. And on an archetypal level, Avalokiteshvara and all the bodhisattvas represent our own inner potential for awakening, and they mirror to us the qualities of enlightened beings. So Buddhism teaches that we are all potentially bodhisattvas and Buddhas, and we all have the potential to awaken as they have. And the bodhisattvas belong to what is known as the Sambhogakaya realm, the realm of the archetypal imagination. And the Sambhogakaya is known as the body of mutual enjoyment, or the body of bliss, or clear light manifestation. And it sits between the Noumanakaya, which is the created body of the Buddha that manifests in time and space, and the Dharmakaya, or the truth body, which embodies the principle of enlightenment and knows no limits or boundaries. And there's a beautiful poem called The Bodhisattva's Prayer, which was written by Shantideva, an 8th century Buddhist monk and scholar who also wrote the Bodhicharyavatara. And it goes, may I be a protector for those without one, a guide for all travellers on the way. May I be a bridge, a boat, and a ship for all who wish to cross the water. May I be an island for those who seek one, and a lamp for those desiring light. May I be a bed for all who wish to rest, and a slave for all who want a slave. May I be a wishing jewel, a magic vase, powerful mantras and great medicine. May I become a wish-fulfilling tree and a cow of plenty for the world. Just like space and the great elements such as earth, may I always support the life of all the boundless creatures. And until they pass away from pain, may I also be the source of life for all the realms of varied beings that reach unto the ends of space. So Buddhism sees Bodhi, or the realization of transcendent wisdom, as the ultimate goal of every form of sentient existence. Life is for the sake of enlightenment, and the essentials of life are those things which are helpful to the attainment of enlightenment. So the truly simple life is said to be that which is dedicated solely to the attainment of supreme wisdom, where ultimately every thought, word, and deed is integrated to the achievement of that end. So killing, stealing, wrong means of livelihood, and all other forms of unskillful action must eventually be given up, until only those that support supreme wisdom remain. And on a mundane, everyday level, it's hard to imagine that we could come close to manifesting as a bodhisattva. And our founder Sangha Rachita says it is more practical to take the Bodhisattva as representing the universal, even an omnipresent spiritual energy at work in the universe, an energy we can get a sense of every now and then. We may not literally think of being a Bodhisattva, but we can be open to the ideal and aspire to be a channel for that particular energy within our own lives. So we have to stay close to our actual situation and not get lost in unrealistic aspirations. But the Mahayana does convey the spirit of the whole process and that it takes place within a much wider, even a cosmic context. So Bodhisattvas and those aspiring to the Bodhisattva ideal practice the six paramitas or the six perfections for the attainment of enlightenment or awakening for all living beings. And dana, or generosity, is the first of the six paramitas and is a basic Buddhist virtue. So according to the Dharma, we should be giving in some way every day. And it's not so much about the giving itself, but the feeling of wanting to give, of wanting to share what we have with others. And often this feeling of wanting to give is the first manifestation of the spiritual life. It can indicate the first sign that craving and attachment are decreasing. And there are many ways that we can give. And these include the giving of material things or the good things in life, like food, clothing, money, shelter, and potentially whatever can be possessed. So some people make it a practice to give something material every day. It could be food, small amounts of money, or simply offering someone a cup of tea. And there is the giving of time, of energy, of thought. The time is very precious to many of us. And if we can give some of our time to regularly helping or being available to others, then this is a form of dana. And there is the giving of knowledge, of culture and education. So this is regarded very highly in Buddhism, where any intellectual knowledge acquired of the Dharma is regarded as being not just for oneself, but for sharing with and benefiting others. And the giving of culture also includes the Bodhisattva's great gift of beauty and inspiration. So there is also the giving of fearlessness, which may sound like a really strange gift to be able to give. But we can create a feeling of fearlessness in others by our presence at times. We can reassure people, allay their fears and anxieties with our confidence. So Buddhism sees this as a really important contribution. And there is the giving of the gift of the Dharma, or the Buddha's teachings. So this is the gift of truth and understanding of the way to enlightenment or awakening. And this is said to be the greatest gift of all. And there's also the giving of ourselves and spiritual friendship with others. So ultimately, the Bodhisattva gives all of herself in relationship with other people. And there's a story about how Ananda, the Buddha's closest disciple, said to the Buddha one day, "I think that half of the holy life is spiritual friendship." And the Buddha replied, "That's not so. Say not so, Ananda. It is not half of the holy life. It is the whole of the holy life." So we often have a tendency not to give but to take, often with any new opportunity that comes our way in connection with work, home or entertainment even, we have a half-conscious reaction of what's in it for me. We have the self-referential tendency to grasp at things, and craving often dominates our lives. So we need to continuously practice to reverse this tendency, and giving is the first paramita or perfection because it is the direct opposite of grasping and craving. It is said that you may not be morally scrupulous, you may not be able to meditate for even 5 minutes at a time, you may not dip into the scriptures from one year to the next, but if you aspire to lead any sort of higher life, then at the very least you will give. And if you are even a little bit open-handed, then there is some hope for you. So the giving of material objects is not just about handing over our possessions or money. Above all, we give generously with an open heart and mind. We give with our whole being. So Sangha Rachita has said in the past that one of the most pleasing features of Buddhism that he experienced in the East was people's wonderful generosity. How in all his years in India, he witnessed people practicing dana and giving every day. and he really hoped that Buddhists in the West would eventually develop the same capacity to give as what he witnessed in the East. So who do we give to? Whom do we practice generosity towards? Well, Buddhism says that that all sentient beings are the objects of the Bodhisattva's generosity, and there are three classes of recipients. So firstly, we give to our own friends and families. There's that old saying that charity begins at home. So we begin with those closest to us, our partners, our siblings, our parents, our children, our extended families, and our friends. And then we extend our generosity out into the world to strangers, and even those people we may find difficult. They are all living, breathing human beings, just as we are. So we reflect on our common humanity, our shared desire for peace and happiness, and we give wherever we see the need. So our generosity begins at home, and then secondly we extend it towards the poor, the sick, the afflicted, the helpless, and all animals. And in our traditional Metta-bhavana practice, or loving-kindness practice, we start by cultivating metta towards ourselves, which is a big practice for some of us. And then we extend metta towards a good friend. And only after we've done this do we start expanding our metta, or universal friendliness, to a neutral person. And as we cultivate and fan the flame of metta within our hearts, we extend further to include someone we're having difficulty with. And in the final stage of our metta practice, we allow metta to flow out wider and wider to encompass all living beings and beyond, as far as our imaginations will allow us to go. So our metta-bhavana practice is very good training for developing our capacity to be generous to both ourselves and others. And thirdly, we're encouraged to give to those who are living a full-time Buddhist life. And traditionally that would mean supporting monks, nuns, lamas and full-time spiritual teachers so that they can devote their lives to studying and teaching the Dharma for the benefit of others. And this third group also includes giving to those people who are devoted to higher creative work, the painters, the artists, the writers, so that they can have complete freedom to create beauty and literature that inspires the pursuit of the highest spiritual aspirations of others. So how do we give? Well, we give courteously, happily and equally, whether the recipient is a beggar or an animal. And we give quickly without delay before we have time to change our minds. And we're encouraged to learn the art of giving without regret and without talking about it with other people, without drawing public attention to our acts of generosity. So some people give to gain a good reputation, and they may have conditions attached to the giving, like I must have my name on that building or sign. And others give because they think it might help get them to heaven, or they're storing up treasure that will one day be recognised by a higher power. But as Buddhists and potential bodhisattvas, we're not giving for those reasons. We give to both friend and foe, to the good and the bad, giving according to real needs and not apparent wants. So we're encouraged to cultivate a constant outflow of giving to counter our relentless process of taking in. And we practice this type of giving because it leads to the destruction of greed. And ultimately, the Dana Paramita is the perfection of giving. It's a transcendental giving where generosity is conjoined with shunyata, the true nature of reality. And it leads to pranya, or wisdom, the direct realization and experience of reality itself. So when the bodhisattva gives in this way, there is no idea of self, no idea of other, even no idea of the act of giving. Eventually, we give with perfect awareness. We're giving as natural, spontaneous, and inexhaustible. We give in the spirit of compassion in accordance with the needs of sentient beings. So sila is the second paramita perfection, and it embodies the individualistic, self-regarding aspect of Buddhist life. So sila translates as uprightness or morality, and a skillful action that benefits ourselves and others, helping us to grow and develop as wise and compassionate human beings. and it encompasses both our mental attitudes and the behaviour that arises from them. So it is everything we actively do that arises from our skillful mental states, especially those actions arising from love, generosity, peace, and contentment. And in Buddhism, we speak of actions being either skillful or unskillful. And if we can think of sila or ethics as a skill, we can see that it has nothing to do with being obedient to an outside authority. It's about taking responsibility for our own actions and making wise choices that cause no harm to others. And traditionally in Buddhism, we have five precepts that form the basis of sila, and they have both a positive and a negative formulation. So the positive formulation is, with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. With open-handed generosity, I purify my body. With truthful communication, I purify my speech. With mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. And the negative formulation is, I undertake to abstain from taking life. I undertake to abstain from taking the not given. I undertake to abstain from sexual misconduct. I undertake to abstain from false speech. And I undertake to abstain from taking intoxicants. And these also expand into 10 precepts that, when practiced well, lead to the purification of body, speech, and mind. So there are three main areas of life that sila or Buddhist ethics can be applied, and these are food, work, and our personal relationships. So in the first precept, the bodhisattva and those following the ideal abstain from taking life. He cultivates a reverence for all of life and sees the value in all life forms. And this ideally leads to embracing vegetarianism, and some would say ultimately veganism. And this also extends to not causing any kind of harm to living beings. And the positive counterpart of violence is the practice of maitri, or metta, or loving kindness, which is expressed in skillful action. In the second precept, the bodhisattva abstains from theft, fraud, or any kind of dishonesty, misappropriation, or exploitation, which are all expressions of craving or selfish desire. And the positive counterpart of this is dana, or generosity, and not just the will to give, but the generous act itself. And the third precept is abstention from sexual misconduct, which causes harm to ourselves and other human beings. So great ethical care is needed in the whole area of sex and romantic relationships, where there is potential to cause so much harm. The positive counterpart is contentment, finding contentment if being single, and being single if you are, or contentment with your partner if you have one. And it also means cultivating a positive state of freedom from being driven by strong desires and romantic longings. So the fourth precept is abstention from false speech, speech that originates from craving, hatred, or fear. So untruthfulness arises from unskillful mental states. And to counter these, we endeavour to practice right speech, speaking truthfully, speaking with love and affection, with real feeling for those being spoken to, speaking in accordance with the needs of others and in a way that promotes harmony, unity, and mindfulness. And the fifth precept is abstention from drink or drugs that result in loss of awareness. And there can be some disagreement about the interpretation of this precept. In some Buddhist circles, it is interpreted as total abstinence, and in others as requiring moderation in the use of anything which, if taken in excess, would result in intoxication. And the positive counterpart of this precept is mindfulness or awareness, cultivating a clear and radiant mind. So ethics are implicitly interwoven with the practice of dana or giving, the reverence for life, open-handed generosity, the development of kindness and compassion for all beings. And I've been around the Auckland Buddhist Centre for around 16 years, and during that time I've come into contact with many generous people within the Triyatna Buddhist community, And there are so many people who have given their time, energy and resources and continue to do so. And I have enormous gratitude towards those people, some of whom have since died. And bringing to mind the people we feel gratitude towards can be a great preliminary practice for both metta and dana, or generosity. And there does seem to come a point in our dharma practice where we see that spiritual practice and what we're discovering is not just for us, where we see that we're no longer here just to make our own lives easier or better. It's no longer about reducing our personal anxieties and fears or for healing our own suffering, if that's why we first came along. I know it was for me. We can come to a point where we see that we're all in this together and we naturally want to give back. We want to help others. We want to be of some kind of compassionate service to help create a better world for all beings. And it may not be that it's conscious. It just starts to naturally happen. And as that process slowly unfolds, our preoccupation with selfing seems to fall away and our dharma practice opens and deepens as a result. And I've noticed over the years that when people give from an open heart, joy arises. It seems that giving is really good for us and it can be quite contagious. It makes us feel great. And I've spoken quite a lot about giving, but personally I've noticed one of my biggest areas of dharma practice is the practice of receiving people's generosity. You know, I've come to the conclusion at times that it's something I'm not always very skillful at. I find it really hard to receive generosity from others, and I'm having to learn to be more gracious and open in that area. And I think it may come from a deep-seated false view that I must take care of myself and that I shouldn't expect others to do that for me. But I'm learning to slowly let go of that. It's a real practice, and I'm finding it very humbling at times. So one of the greatest gifts that I have received through being involved with Sri Ratna is that of spiritual friendship. And some of these friendships began when I first started coming along, and they've slowly deepened over the years to become some of the most enriching friendships of my life. And there's an opportunity here to go well beyond the surface of polite conversation and to transform and grow through exploring the Dharma together with others from different backgrounds, different conditionings, and often very different views. So no one can practice the Dharma for us. We have to practice it ourselves, but we don't have to practice it alone. So within Triatna, we place great emphasis on cultivating spiritual friendship, and we do this by offering the gift of our friendship to others. And we can practice Dana and Sila in this way by being generous to our friends, giving them our time and attention, speaking kindly and truthfully to them, and being concerned for their spiritual welfare, treating them the same as we would treat ourselves. We communicate the Dharma by practicing friendship in this way. Some would even say that spiritual friendship is the Dharma. And spiritual friendship doesn't involve any kind of power relationship. It's friendship based on maitri, or loving kindness. And we call it Kalyana Mitrata, which means lovely friendship, or friendship with the beautiful. And we heard earlier how the Buddha said that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. But the Buddha was also saying that it is not just having spiritual friends, but it's also about our intimacy with the lovely, our connection with the beautiful, our openness to realising the true nature of reality. So our spiritual friends are our companions on the path to awakening, and they support our explorations and development. So this is what is truly beautiful, and that is what inspires us to stay on the path. So spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, can be between more experienced and less, or between those of equal experience. And this kind of friendship, which takes time, effort and awareness to cultivate, forms the very basis of a sangha, or a spiritual community. And it's also important to develop friendships with those who are even a little more spiritually advanced than we are, as they are probably going to be more important in our lives than even a Buddha or a Bodhisattva would be. We may not even recognise a Buddha or a Bodhisattva if we met one, but we will probably recognise the value and qualities of a true spiritual friend. And I just want to end with a really beautiful passage from the Jewel Ornament of Liberation of Gampopa, in which, speaking of spiritual friends, Gampopa says, Since at the beginning of our career, it is impossible to be in touch with the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas living on a high level of spirituality. We have to meet with ordinary human beings as spiritual friends. And as soon as the darkness caused by our deeds has lightened, we can find Bodhisattvas on a high level of spirituality. And then when we have risen above the great preparatory path, we can find the new Manakai of the Buddha. And finally, as soon as we live on a high spiritual level, we can meet with a Sambhogakaya as a spiritual friend. Should you ask who among these four is our greatest benefactor? The reply is that in the beginning of our career, when we are still living imprisoned by our deeds and emotions, we will not even see so much as the face of a superior spiritual friend. Instead, we will have to seek an ordinary human being who can illumine the path we have to follow with the light of his or her counsel, whereafter we shall meet superior ones. Therefore, the greatest benefactor is a spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being. Thank you.